Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the eighth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Hey, guess what? There's an election coming up. Our conversation today is about election 2024. What's on your ballot? This month, as we do each election year, we're going to preview the upcoming election and provide information about the races, the ballot questions, which races will use ranked choice voting, how and when to vote, etc. This show is pre-recorded on October 15th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Randy Billings is the political reporter for the Portland Press Herald. We're very pleased to have you today, Randy. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And Anna Keller is the executive director for the League of Women Voters of Maine and for Democracy Maine. Welcome, Anna.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So let's get started. Anna, let's dig right in. When is Election Day? What do people have to know about voter registration? What to keep in mind before November 5th?
Absolutely. Well, Election Day, like you said, is November 5th. We have up until the Thursday before you can request an absentee ballot without needing an excuse. If you get to the point of it's after the Thursday before the election and you need an absentee ballot, you can still get one if you know you're going to be out of town that day or you're sick. There are some valid excuses that you can use to get one, but we would certainly encourage everybody who thinks you might want one to sign up for it right away and to turn it back in as soon as possible. That's the most important deadline to keep in mind. We're very lucky in Maine that you can have, you can register to vote all the way up through Election Day. So we don't have a cutoff for that in terms of in-person voter registration. So if you need to register at the polling place and vote on Election Day, that is also possible.
Anything else you want to add to that, Randy? Important things to keep in mind, drop boxes, you know, absentee voting, anything like that?
I think Anna's the pro on that, so I think she covered it pretty well.
All right, well, let's dig right into what's on the Maine ballot. People who have asked for and received their absentee ballot or people voting on Election Day, what are they going to see on page one? Like the top of the ballot is going to be the presidential, right, Randy? How many candidates? Maybe more than people think.
Yeah, we do. So we have four tickets that are going to be on the ballot. Of course, you have Donald Trump and J.D. Vance on the Republican ticket. On the Democratic side, you have Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. You have a Libertarian ticket and you have a Green ticket as well, Jill Stein and Rudolph Ware. Well, actually, no. And then there's another one. There's five. There's the Justice for All ticket with Cornel West and Melina Abdullah. And there are also four declared write-in campaigns, but I won't go through all of those. So it's going to look like a full ballot at the top.
And so that will be a ranked choice election, right, Anna?
Yeah. So for the first time, we are using ranked choice voting in the general election for president. And we've seen a lot of people with questions about this because there are people who may be thinking that they would want to vote for one of those third party or write-in candidates and wanting to understand how they can use ranked choice voting. And so we always encourage people to rank as many candidates as you have a preference for. You can always just vote for one. You can always rank just one candidate if that's all that you want to vote for. But we always encourage people, if you think you have other candidates that you would be okay with, to consider ranking them as well and give the fullest expression of your vote.
So what happens, let's say I'm voting for Cornel West, and if I put Cornel West first all the way across, like I sort of bullet vote Cornel West, does that help Cornel West?
It doesn't help and it doesn't hurt. It just still only counts as if you had put Cornel West as your first choice on that very first one.
Okay, so is there any particular way I can mess that up, that ranked choice thing? Like I can vote two candidates, number one. I guess that would mess me up, right?
Yeah. So no more than one candidate per slot. So you see your little grid of bubbles, and we always say it's okay if you're going to vote. It doesn't hurt to vote people all the way down. Doesn't help them either. But you don't want to vote more than one person for first choice. At that point, your ballot would be disqualified.
So let's say I kind of want to make a little protest vote, and maybe I want to vote Jill Stein first. How would that work, Randy? I vote Jill Stein first and Kamala Harris second. No problem, or?
Yeah, I mean, there wouldn't be a problem. Assuming, you know, no one gets 50% of the vote on the first run through, I guess, you know, if you want to lodge a protest vote, you know, with Jill Stein, you're sort of assuming that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance won't get more than 50%, because if they get over 50%, they're going to win the election. But in the event that they don't, and you want to have a safe second choice of either Kamala Harris and Tim Walz or another ticket, vote for Jill Stein would still count in that first round. No one gets 50%. Your second vote would get allocated as long as she was the lowest vote getter on that. And then your vote would go to Harris and Walz if you put them second.
You want to add anything to that? Add a ranked choice. I mean, this is the top of the ticket, ranked choice. And there are going to be some other ranked choice races here, but this is the one where people are really thinking, how is it going to work?
I mean, this is exactly the reason why we want to have ranked choice in this kind of election is we see all the time these arguments about having to vote for the lesser of two evils, people yelling at their friends about, you know, spoiling the election by voting third party, all of those things that can make such a negative part of the election cycle. And really, ranked choice voting is helping us to get away from that. Like Randy said, it's not completely risk-free because a candidate could still win on the first ballot, and then your protest vote would not have helped in any way. But
it wouldn't hurt either, right?
Yeah, okay. It's a really great thing. In order to get people having more choices, and then hopefully feeling like they can go enthusiastically to the polls, because, you know, that's the thing that we would say most of all is if you don't vote, then you're really giving up any power that you have in this election. So the fact that we have more choices, five opt tickets on the ballot and four more write-ins, hopefully among that group, everybody can find one or more of those that they can be enthusiastic about and a few more that they can live with and rank away.
And this might be a good time to jump in and talk a little bit about how Maine sort of allocates its electoral college votes, because there really could possibly be two ranked choice runoffs in the presidential race, if I'm not mistaken, because we have four electoral college votes, and two of those go to the statewide winner. And then one goes to the winner of each congressional district. So in the second congressional district, which is more conservative, you know, where you guys are, WERU, Trump has taken that in the previous two elections. So it's plausible that, you know, I think he's favored to win that again. But in the event that neither Trump nor Harris get a majority on the first ballot in the second congressional district, that too could go to a runoff just to determine who gets that one electoral college vote. And there is one scenario in which, you know, that could be the deciding factor for Trump if he carries Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia. This has actually been gamed out by some political analysts. So that one vote in the second district could get him exactly to 270. So it's going to be an interesting election to watch. We may not know for a few days who wins it.
We keep saying Maine isn't a swing state this year, but actually, when it comes right down to it, there are scenarios where Maine could swing the whole election, wow, or at least the second district.
So in terms of the ranked choice count, what should people expect? And let's say it goes to an actual ranked choice count.
Yeah, so the process for that is that we'll hear on the right away what the tally of those first place rankings are, because that's what's going to determine, okay, we didn't, no one got over 50% of those, and so we're going to ranked choice. At that point, all of the ballots that were cast are assembled, and they are brought, and the cast vote, the information about the votes that were cast are all collected centrally in Augusta. That takes a couple of days to get everything securely transported to the Secretary of State, where they will run the ranked choice count, the ranked choice tabulation. So we could expect with that process that we might not see the actual result of that full thing until, let's say, early the following week. That is a safe bet. They work as very, very hard to get all of the ballots transported, but there's always a few things that have to be scanned in Augusta, towns that do hand counts. It takes a little while to run it. What we've seen in the past when we've had these is that I would say candidates and the media have really done a great public service by helping to communicate about that process to the public, to their supporters, and to keep everybody calm throughout that part of the waiting. And then the Secretary of State has done a great job of being transparent with the count itself and watching that tabulation. You can watch it on a live stream through Facebook. It's not very exciting, but it's very good that we do have the ability to see every step of that process.
That's great. Sort of moving down the ballot, I guess we're going to have a ranked choice election in the Senate race also, Randy. Who's there?
Yeah, absolutely. Angus King is running for re-election. He's an independent. He's being challenged this time by Republican Demi Kazunas. And then there's a Democrat on the ballot as well, David Costello from Brunswick. And there's another independent on the ballot as well, Jason Sherry from the, I'm going to probably get this wrong, the Unity area, I believe, a former retired FBI agent. So there's four candidates there, unless, again, someone earns more than 50% of the vote on the first round, that could go to a ranked choice as well.
Are there declared write-ins there also?
Not to my knowledge on that one.
Okay. And then in the first congressional district, because we do stream statewide, we have three candidates there also, right?
Yeah, we do. Do you want to take that one, Anna?
Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, again, you know, incumbent Democrat Shelley Pingree is running again. She's being challenged by Republican Ron Russell, and there's an independent in that race as well, Ethan Alcorn.
So that will be ranked choice voting.
And that, then that one will be, yep.
Yep. And then in the second congressional district, only two candidates are running, right?
Yeah, two candidates. I mean, you have incumbent Jared Golden, a Democrat, being challenged by State Rep Austin Terrio. He's a Republican, just finishing his first two-year term in the state legislature. There is a declared write-in candidate in that race. So there
will
be a line.
Be ranked choice.
So someone could rank, you know, the write-in choice, and then put the information in there. And again, if no one hits 50%, then that would go to an instant runoff.
So interesting, all the federal races then are going to be ranked choice in this election, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. And then just briefly, also on the state ballot will be the county commissioner races. And how many of the counties are electing county commissioners this term?
Yeah, all 16 counties will have some seats up for grabs. I think the ones probably mm-hmm. most relevant to your listeners would be, there's a couple in Hancock County, a couple mm-hmm. in Waldo, and one each in Aroostook and Penobscot counties.
Okay. And then below that, all the state legislative races, all the state house and all the state senate races are being are up for election. Some are uncontested, but people will see all those races on their ballots as well.
They will. 186 seats. That's 35 in the Senate, 151 in the House. Democrats currently have a hold on both of those chambers.
Yeah. And I want to just make two mentions about these down ballot state races. One thing for people to remember is that we don't use ranked choice voting in the general election for these state races. So if you have three or more candidates, you're still going to just vote for one in those races. And then we mentioned the county commissioners, and just want to make a plug for people looking up their county commissioner information. In Vote411, which is our league online voter guide, vote411.org, we have some responses from a few of the candidates there. We're working on getting them all in. And then there's been some media coverage of a few of these races. This is often an office that people don't pay a lot of attention to, don't really know what it does. They oversee huge budgets, and they have a major impact on our county jails and criminal justice system. And so take a little time and do a little research about those offices if they're on your ballot. It's an area that I think an individual voter can have a pretty significant difference when it comes to those elections, and often we overlook them.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is Election 2024. What's on your ballot? Our guests this afternoon are Anna Keller, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Maine, and Randy Billings, political reporter for the Portland Press Herald. This program was pre-recorded on October 15th. No listener calls are being taken. Randy, do you have other, like, does the Portland Press Herald or other news outlets have sites as well as vote411.org that people could go to for information about candidates or the election? You want to plug one of those right now?
Yeah, well, we've been covering the races as they've been unfolding. So we do have a landing page for all of our election coverage. And on there, you'll find Q&As for all the referendum questions that are on the ballot, some short video explainers of each of those questions, candidate profiles of the Senate and representative races. And we've been highlighting what some of the battleground races will be in the state legislature. You know, like I said, the Democrats are looking to hold their majorities in each chamber. They have a 9-seat advantage in the Senate now, 12-seat advantage in the House of Representatives. And these are going to be pretty tough fought races. I think the Republicans are feeling pretty good about their chances of flipping, you know, one of the chambers. And I know the Democrats are working hard to hold on to it. So your vote will be important for sure in all these races.
Great. All right, let's turn now to the ballot questions and just sort of walk through the questions one at a time and help people, because I think this is one area of the ballot that doesn't get that much attention. Just introduce us to question one, Anna. What does it say and what does it mean?
So question one that you'll be asked on the ballot, do you want to set a $5,000 limit for giving to political action committees that spend money independently to support or defeat candidates for office? And so this is a yes vote means you want to enact that ban, a no vote means you don't. This is really attempting to get at all of the huge amounts of outside spending that we are seeing, the dark money that's been coming into our elections for the last 15 years or so. It is a issue that is taking aim at some Supreme Court decisions. And so the folks behind this are looking to hopefully get this law passed in Maine and then have it set up where it would go to federal courts and maybe even up to the Supreme Court in order to challenge some of the Supreme Court decisions that have made it not possible to limit this kind of election spending. That's, we've seen that there's been a lot of support in Maine in the past. We had an election last year with a very strongly supported measure to reduce the impact of money in politics. We've seen a lot of bipartisan voter support for this. And so folks who were looking to try to bring this test case were looking at Maine as a place that could get that done.
Randy, what is your reporting telling you about question one?
Well, this one was interesting because it took me a little while to kind of wrap my head around it because it, the way I've kind of come to understand it is sort of like this sort of fire hose of like campaign money, right? You've got like the, you got the amount of money that's coming in and then you got the amount that's going out and blasting, right? So Citizens United, as I understand it, and I'm sure Anna will correct me if I'm wrong, it said that the fire hose that these PACs can spray out into the race to try to influence voters, you can't stifle that. That's political speech. They haven't really ruled on the front end of that fire hose yet. Like, can individuals and businesses put unlimited contributions into these PACs? And it's my understanding that that's the what this question is trying to get after. They're trying to enact a limit on individual contributions to these super PACs that spend specifically to advocate for the election or defeat of a candidate. And then the hope is there that that would be challenged in court and then make it all the way up to the Supreme Court, where they feel like that they could get a ruling in their favor on that and set a new limit. This would, like I said, Maine would be the first to do this, to push it through the courts. And it has, it would have impacts here in the state. I mean, if you just think back a couple of years ago to the gubernatorial election, you know, there's a national conservative activist, Tom Klingstein. He personally donated about $3 million to a political action committee that pretty much exclusively ran attack ads against Governor Janet Mills when she was running against Paula Page. That kind of contribution would not be allowed if this passes. And even just this year, Leonard Leo, another conservative activist, has given $300,000 or so to a political action committee that is connected to a state lawmaker who is trying to win back Republican control of the House. Again, that wouldn't be permitted if this question passes. But what would be exempted from this limit, if I'm understanding this correctly, is that people and organizations could still give unlimited amounts of monies to party political action committees. So the Maine Democratic Party, the Maine Republican Party. I just did a story about Stephen King donating over $430,000 to Maine Democrats. That would be fine if this is approved. And also ballot question committees. So the group behind this one, Citizens to End Super PACs, folks could still give unlimited amounts to a ballot question committee like that.
You want to add anything to that, Anna?
Just say that our sister organization, Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, has done some analysis on this question. We've talked to a lot of people who are looking at the legality and what routes might actually allow us to change the way the Supreme Court has been ruling and be able to put some restrictions in place. And this is certainly not a question that everybody is in agreement on, that there's a clear path to a Supreme Court decision here. And so a lot of what I'm thinking about and advising voters who might want to support this question is that it might end up being a protest vote. It might end up being something that gets overturned by the Supreme Court. We've seen quite a few of those. But even we've also heard from advocates for this that even if that's what happens, it's one more thing putting pressure on a future court to make different decisions. It's one more thing showing where the voters really want to be on these issues. So if it were to win, it could help build momentum for a constitutional amendment. So some of those sort of organizing and pressure building questions and are also a part of the strategy, though, of course, the advocates for this would like to see it succeed in their attempt with the court.
Randy, is there organized opposition to question one?
I mean, there's nothing on file with the state ethics commission. You know, if you're going to be a player in these electoral politics, these ballot questions, you got to register if you're going to spend a certain amount of money. They don't have anything on file for any organized opposition, but I'm sure some of these mega donors wouldn't support this. But to the extent that they're organizing against it, I haven't seen anything at this point.
Okay, question one. Any wrap up there, or should we go on to question two?
Just to say that that's because those major donors think the courts are going to do their work for them while they know that these bans are quite popular with voters. So why make the effort in front of the voters if they think they can just get the courts to knock it down after the fact?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, Randy, what's question two?
All right, question two. It's a very long question. Would you like me to read it, or would you like your listeners to just go look it up?
I think you better read it.
Okay, here it comes. Bear with me. Do you favor a bond issue of $25 million to provide funds to be awarded through a competitive process and to leverage matching private and federal funds on at least a one-to-one basis for research and development and commercialization for Maine-based public and private institutions in support of technological innovation in the targeted sectors of life sciences, biomedical technology, environmental and renewable energy technology, information technology, advanced technologies for forestry and agriculture, aquaculture, and marine technology, composites, and advanced materials and precision manufacturing.
Yikes, that's a mouthful. What does that actually, right? What does that actually mean, Randy?
Basically, it's a, do you want to authorize the state to borrow $25 million for research and development? So if you vote yes on this, you're giving the state permission to borrow that money. Any bond at the state level has to be approved by voters, which is why we're voting on this. And if you vote no, then the state simply won't borrow the money and that money won't be available to folks.
Who was behind this in the legislature? Who was advocating for it?
Yeah, well, whereas question one is on the ballot as a result of a citizens initiative, you know, a group of citizens went out and collected the signatures to get that on the ballot. Question two is on the ballot due to a state law that was proposed by Teresa Pierce, a Democrat from Falmouth. It had bipartisan support. So rather, you know, the legislature could have enacted this. Well, no, they couldn't have. This is slightly different. So this didn't have any opposition. It went right through. And it will be on the ballot. And if it's approved, this funding would be available over a certain number of years through a competitive grant process. It would be overseen by the Maine Technology Institute. The projects would sort of have to be in line with what they have action plans, the Institute does, as well as the Maine Department of Economic and Community Development. They don't have, you know, the exact details and the rules for how the funding would be dispersed at this point. That would come after approval, but all that would be announced before time. And folks would be able to compete for the money through grant applications. It would could support major capital projects like building new facilities, renovating existing ones, buying land, equipment, or upgrading technology. The entities that receive the funding would have to put in the same amount of funding. So if you get $5 million through this fund, the recipient would also have to put their $5 million in. We did this a few years ago. There was a $50 million bond. It was approved by 61% of the voters. And according to the Maine Technology Institute, you know, 18 or so projects were funded through that. And they say it generated more than 5,000 jobs and over $1.4 billion in economic impact for the state. And a couple projects that your listeners might be familiar with was a state-of-the-art research mouse production facility that got funding, Jackson Laboratory. That new facility was in Ellsworth. There was an aerospace company in Bangor that got some funding. And then, you know, just a whole host of projects.
Is there any opposition to this?
Again, none organized, but I know pocketbook issues and are going to be a top of mind for folks. But that right now, there's only one group that's registered with the state to spend money to promote this, and it's Invest in Maine's Future. Mm-hmm. It's a ballot committee that's led by Patrick Woodcock, who is the CEO of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. And coincidentally, Jackson Lab is one of the largest donors to that political action committee. They put in $16,000. Of the 70,000 that the group has raised. So it takes money to make money, I guess.
Right, probably so. All right. I mean, this relate to the next couple of questions, but are there people who argue that the state's debt load is just too high and we shouldn't borrow any more at all? Is that even an argument that floats around or not so much?
I think that's always an argument. Yeah. I think that is always floating around out there, you know. But, you know, Mainers are generally receptive to bond issues. You know, you don't see a lot of them turned down. We don't know if the economic conditions that folks are feeling right now, it's turned up in polling after polling, that the high cost of living and just a variety of pocketbook issues are top of mind of folks this year. So whether, you know, that'll produce a different result, you know, we're not quite sure. We'll have to wait till November 6th to find out.
Yep. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Randy Billings, political reporter for the Portland Press Herald, and Anna Keller, executive director of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is Election 2024. What's on your ballot? This show was pre-recorded. You can send comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. We're going down the ballot bit by bit. We covered the candidates at the top of the ticket, and we covered questions one and two. We're on to question three. And let me ask you to introduce question three, if you don't mind.
Sure. So question three is another bond question. This one was also put forward by legislators and then supported in the legislature and sent out to voters. I can read this one off as well. So question three is, do you favor a $10 million bond issue to restore historic buildings owned by governmental and nonprofit organizations, with funds being issued contingent on a 25% local match requirement from either private or nonprofit sources? So this question is looking to bring funds to be available for historic preservation. Often government and nonprofit owned buildings are not eligible for other sources of historic preservation funding. And so there was a gap identified here. And I believe that this is something that the state has done in the past, but not for a very long time. I think the last time that there was a bond provided around this was in the 80s. So this was brought forward by two Republican legislators and had received strong support in the legislature to then be put out to voters.
Can you add to that, Randy? And who's likely to benefit from this one?
Yeah. So again, the funding, the rules and all that stuff, those would be drafted, you know, when and if this is approved. But if it's anything like it was last time, funding would be available for a certain period of time on an annual basis. The last time it was for a 4-year period. It would be a competitive process. And to be eligible, the building that's being renovated or what have you would have to be either listed on the National Register of Historic Places or be in the process of becoming listed on that. I know you're going to ask about supporters or oppositions in a little bit, but there's nothing on file where folks are spending money to promote or try to defeat this. But there is a coalition that is trying to get Earn Media to promote it. And this will give you an idea probably of who might benefit from this. You know, Maine Preservation, Cultural Alliance of Maine, Maine Library Association, and the Maine Archives. So,
Libraries.
Think of your town library or maybe your town hall is in like a historic building. It's having trouble getting funded, or your library's got the leaky roof and they got that little fundraising thing up there with a little thermometer trying to get it up to that point where they can finally fix it. It's those kind of projects that would be vying for this funding.
Yeah, interesting. You have anything to add on that one, Anna?
No, it's just I think we can all picture buildings in our community that might fall under that kind of benefit from something like this, because we have such a old, built infrastructure in our state. And that's something that you think about all of those, tiny Carnegie libraries in so many of our towns and things like that. We have a lot of historic buildings in Maine, and it's tough to keep up with the maintenance of them all.
And a 25% local match on this one, right? So the town or the city or the nonprofit would have to come up with the seed money to get the match. That's what it says here anyway.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, great. Anything else on question three that you want to highlight?
No, that one's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. So let's go to question four, Randy, and I'll ask you to introduce question four.
All right. Question four. All right. So these next two are going to be fun, I think. Question four, I'll read the question first and then tell you a little bit about it. This one is, do you favor a $30 million bond issue to invest in the design, development, and maintenance for non-motorized, motorized, and multi-use trails statewide to be matched by at least $3 million in private and public contributions? This is a first of its kind trail bond for the state. This one was on the ballot as a result of a bill introduced by Jessica Fay, Representative Jessica Fay, a Democrat from Raymond, Maine. We just have an abundance of outdoor recreational opportunities, and they're in the form of hiking trails, walking trails, cross-country skiing trails, there are snowmobile trails, there are ATV trails, all kinds of trails. And this would create a pool of public funding to help maintain and upgrade those trails, both to repair damage from storms, but also to increase accessibility to folks who can't necessarily get out on that hiking trail that has all the rocks and roots on it. So they improve accessibility for folks who may have to use a wheelchair or walker to get around. and things like that. You know, right now, a lot of that trail maintenance, if it's not owned by a government entity like the state or federal government, it's done, you know, on, it's like, it's a labor of love. It's a volunteer group. It's a snowmobile association, and they're volunteering their time to go out and patch those trails and groom them and do all that stuff. They're funding it largely through donations, but this would open up a larger pool of money that advocates say it's much needed to maintain the trails, and it could result in some additional economic activity in a lot of the more rural areas of the state.
So how are people going to qualify for this money? I mean, it's like a, am I figuring this right, a 10% match, which is a lower match than the other two questions. So it's going to be maybe more accessible than the others. Go ahead.
As far as the funding, that would, I believe the State Bureau of Parks and Lands would distribute it, again, through a competitive grant process. So there'd be an application, and then they would come up with the guidelines and the standards for what projects they're going to fund. It's my understanding that with this funding, it would be distributed over a four-year period. An organization would need to match it with the 10%. And while we're talking about the $30 million here, it's going to be broken up into three different pools. So a quarter of that funding would be allocated for non-motorized trails. So, you know, you're going to just go hike, you're going to pedal those trails. Another 25% for motorized trails for your ATVs, your dirt bikes, and your snowmobiles. And then half of that funding would go to multi-use trails. So they seem to have kind of developed this in a way that really sort of spreads the benefits out. So it's not all going to like a snowmobile trail or a paved bike path, you know, in Southern Maine or something like that. It's designed to be broad.
You want to comment, Anna?
No, I just think this is a really interesting question because it does bring together a lot of different interests. And it seems like it was very carefully crafted in order to ensure that, you know, people who might be hikers or conservationists and people who want to draw in economic revenue into rural communities and enjoy using ATVs and snowmobiles, you know, it's got a little bit of something for everyone in it. And it's clear that that's how it, you know, how something like this could get through the legislature. And so it's certainly interesting to see that process and this coming in for the first time to have this sort of a bond we're so used to seeing, you know, highway infrastructure bonds. The idea of doing something like this for trail infrastructure is really interesting.
Is there organized support or opposition, Randy?
Yeah, as this bill was working its way through the legislature, there was just a massive coalition of folks who were pushing this through, you know, which really isn't easy at the end of a legislative session, especially when it comes down to, you know, counting the pennies at the end of the day. But so proponents have organized a ballot question committee partnership for Maine Trails, and it's controlled. The principal officer is the outreach director of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. And there's no organized opposition to it that I can find at this point. But advocates, they've said that they have over 500 groups that have signed on to support it, including municipalities, you know, clubs and other outdoor organizations. And as we were talking about the broad support, you know, as Anna was earlier, you know, the groups that have signed on to it, it's the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, it's the L.L. Bean, it's Maine Municipal Association, Maine Tourism Association. So it's really very a broad swath of support behind this.
Anna, from what you know, is there sort of like a ballot question exhaustion thing, like where people are likely to vote yes at the top of the list and then just get tired and vote no at the bottom of the list? Does that happen?
That's a really interesting question. What we tend to see is people vote no on things they're confused on. I wonder, you know, and I'm purely speculating here, if the first of these question two might be the thing that would have the hardest time because of that very long question. It has a very long list of specific types of industry and research that it could benefit. And so I would assume that most people will see something on that list that they think it's a good idea to invest in and support. But conversely, I guess somebody could see that long list and think, I don't think I like, you know, that any one of those, I don't want an investment in aquaculture or, you know, something like that, and vote no. But like Randy said earlier, we do tend to see that bonds pass at a very high rate. And so we tend to go into these with the thought that if it's gotten through the process of getting past the legislature, getting onto the ballot, there's a good chance that it is going to pass, though we, of course, don't take that for granted, and voters should do their due diligence.
Right. Well, and as long as I ask the question about the order on which these things appear, Randy, can you tell people how it's determined which questions come first, second, third, fourth, fifth? Then we'll go to the last question.
Oh, yeah. Well, I may kick that one to Anna. I know the Secretary of State office determines that, but that's not on a first come, first serve basis. Is it? Is that, that's a result of a drawing, right? Do they do some sort of drawing on that? You might have stumped us on that one. I wasn't ready for that
I
one.
I know there's Sorry. A rule about citizen initiatives coming first and then followed by bond questions, but within the order of the bond questions, no, that's a good trivia.
Okay. I'm not supposed to speak in my own voice, but they draw lots on those. So go ahead, Anna, say what you were going to say. The citizen initiatives, go ahead, come first.
Yeah, so a citizen initiative always comes first. So however many of those that we have that are generated through that process of people collecting signatures to put it on the ballot, then you bond issues. And then I'm guessing from the what we are seeing on the ballot this year, that we then have anything that is directly placed to voters by the legislature that isn't a bond will then come after Next. That. So that's what question five is this year, is a piece that was put directly to the voters by the legislature.
All right, one more station break, and then we'll talk about question five. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Randy Billings, political reporter for the Portland Press Herald, and Anna Keller, executive director for the League of Women Voters of Maine. This program was pre-recorded on October 15th. No listener calls are being taken at this time. Okay, so question five, Randy.
Well, this is the one I think is obviously drawing the most attention. This is about changing the Maine state flag from its current design to a version of the 1901 flag. So the question will be, do you favor making the former state flag replaced as the official flag of the state in 1909 and commonly known as the Pine Tree Flag, the official flag of the state? I mean, this is really fascinating to watch during the last session, because it really did produce, you know, some of the more emotional arguments and some of the more closer votes, you know, that we saw, you know, second perhaps to only reproductive rights issues and you know, ditching the electoral college proposal. But it's been tried for years to change the state flag. And, you know, a lot of the excitement around this has been this commercialized version that you've seen, you know, hanging on people's doorsteps and on stickers on their cars from a Portland flag company, just a stylized pine tree with a blue star up in the upper corner. So,
okay, so wait yeah, a minute. That yeah, was just yeah, somebody's sure. good idea to make money, to recreate this old version and sell it, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, they researched it and they liked the design and they started putting it out there. I mean, because this debate's been going on for years about changing the Maine state flag, just because the existing flag, you know, it's not really unique. You know, a lot of states have a flag similar to ours, which is, you know, it's just a blue field and it has the state seal right in the middle of it. And on that seal, there is a sailor and you got a farmer and you got a moose on a pine tree. But if you put that up, you know, next to a lot of other state flags, you may be hard pressed to choose Maine's flag. So, you know, a lot of the flag experts say you want something that people can, it's got to be a simple design. And when people see it, they think of your state. That's really what you want out of a flag. And this design has really, you know, captivated people's attention. I mean, we have a history with that flag in this state, and it's certainly proven to be a popular commercial design. But when they were talking about this in the legislature, it was very interesting to hear the arguments, because it sort of really came back to this sense of tradition In Maine, where opponents were just basically like they viewed it almost like a part of a continuing assault on Maine's tradition and the way life has been here, and they saw it as sort of a move by Southern Maine, you know, oddly enough, to sort of change the flag. And then, you know, once they sort of got past that a little bit, there was the debate about what sort of pine tree, you know, were you going to have on there? Were you just going to take the one from the Portland Flag Company and put that to voters? Well, a representative from Skowhegan said, wait a minute, I have a flag maker in my town and they're doing a flag that has a realistic pine tree. So we're going to put them out of business. So then this whole debate, you know, started going back and forth. And ultimately what they decided to do, they said, well, we'll let the Secretary of State put together a group of folks to come up with a design, and we'll offer that to voters in November. So what Secretary of State ended up doing is having a design contest. So they put out a call for proposals, and anyone could submit their design, and they did. Apparently,
how many did they get, you know?
Yeah, they got like over 400 entries from 42 different states. I think they even got entries from Canada and England. And we do have some of those available on our website with some of our reporting on these to see all the different variations that people proposed. So then once they got all those in, they narrowed it down to 10, and then they had a committee come in and take a look and recommend the final design. And they ended up choosing one from a designer in Gardner, Adam Lemire. And his was it's a realistic looking pine tree. It has 16 boughs on it, you know, one for each county in the state. Yeah. And then you got the blue star up in the corner. And then there was also a debate about whether there'd be roots on the tree. And this one has the three roots, which is to
symbolize. What was that debate? Roots or no roots? What was that about? Sorry.
I mean, it was just, well, the original one had roots, and the stylized one that everyone likes doesn't have any roots. And then we're like, it's just an example of like the minutia that this debate sort of went into as people were like really trying to like change minds on this. But in the end, we got three roots, one for each branch of government. And it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out, because the only polling that we've seen on it, it's, you know, it was a tie. You know, like maybe a month ago, it was a 40% supported the new design, 40% opposed it. And then you had the 20% who were just totally undecided about it. So this will be a real wild card this fall.
What are you seeing or hearing, Anna? Go ahead.
Just that this is really a fascinating question, because, you know, you might say of the, you know, all the questions on the ballot this year, all the things people are voting on, this is maybe the least consequential to people's daily lives. And yet it's the one that people are feeling the most passionately about, maybe after president, then you come down to this question. It really goes to show how important symbols can be, and that people really do attach strong emotional importance to those symbols. And so the idea of coming up with a flag that represents the state, we maybe are a little bit, you know, we can be divided on this too. It's been very interesting, though, to hear people's thoughts about it, and that just about everyone has an opinion or can quickly come to an opinion about something like this. We found it was very helpful, actually, for engaging with people when we were out doing voter education, tabling at different events this year, because this was a question that people, you know, immediately came in and were like, oh yeah, I have opinions. I could talk about that. I participate in a straw poll about that, you know, maybe more so than something that was a little bit more abstract. So it's been very interesting from that voter engagement perspective. The other thing that I certainly found interesting looking at this question, you know, thinking about what it makes it distinct, that makes our, you know, makes our state distinct from others and distinct from other flags. When I was in the Capitol earlier this year, looking for Senator King's office, and we were kind of wandering down the hall, trying to figure out the room that we were going for. And it's true that Maine's flag looks a lot like several other states' flags. So at the end of the hallway, we were going, wait, is that it? And, you know, going off and nope, that's not it. That was a different state. So from that sheer factor of identification, there's not too many times you have to identify something by the main flag outside the door, but that was one of them, and certainly would have been useful. So I had to laugh a little bit thinking about that use of the symbol. But certainly, when we've talked to people about this, the other comment that we heard was, why couldn't we have a ranked choice ballot? And it's clear, to be clear, we're not using ranked choice voting on this. You get to vote for
up or down,
keep the flag we have or this one that's being proposed. But there were people who said, well, but what if we got to vote on several different versions of it and say, you know, one with the roots, one without the roots? And it part of me thinks that would be a good idea, because certainly this is an area where we have a lot of strong opinions, but perhaps you could use ranked choice voting to come to a consensus around it. But that is not what we're doing. And so instead we get an up or down vote on this proposal.
So a yes vote on this, we get the new flag. A no vote, we keep the old flag, right?
Okay. Correct.
Right.
And Randy, do you know why we changed it in 1909 or whenever? What was the history of the change?
I did it one time, but I don't have it right off the top of my head. But I do know that the arguments against changing it this time did go back to when we changed it to the current flag. And they noticed opponents were talking about just the amount of process and official sort of legislative action and these working groups that came up with that design and how they intentionally chose the color blue for, you know, for the Civil War and all that stuff. I mean, it did come up during the debate quite a bit, but the details of that has escaped me. Okay. What sort of captivates sort of my attention now these days is just, you know, what Anna has said, just how everyone sort of seems to have an opinion about this. And our readers gobble up stories about this flag debate all the time. It's crazy. And I don't know if, have you guys heard the song that's out there about this? I mean, there's no organized support or opposition for this, but there is a song in opposition to it. It's called Leave the Main Flag Alone. And it's by Jason Carey and Scott Fish. We got a press release about it a few weeks back. And one of the taglines they keep coming back to is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And the crux of the song is, don't we have, you know, more important things, you know, to be dealing with as a state than this? So it's pretty comical. Folks are definitely finding their own unique way of expressing themselves on it. And this duo, they decided to write a song about it.
So there is a little organized opposition is what you're saying. Is there organized support also?
One of the leading flag experts, in the country, you know, lives in Maine, and he's been he's been a big proponent of getting this flag changed. And he was actually our guest at a Newsroom Live event that we did a few weeks ago. And my colleague up at the State House, Rachel Ohm, had a great conversation with him just about the history of the flag, efforts to change it over the years, national context about other states that have changed their flags recently. And the experience that we're having here, it didn't sound like it was that uncommon. Like, it is, you know, it's a big deal to folks. They put a lot of energy and meaning into a flag, and it stirs strong emotions. And, you know, some states are still arguing about the new flag that they voted to adopt. So we'll be hearing a lot about this after the election, I suspect, regardless of which way it goes.
Is there any money on either side? Like, donors on either side, or is it mostly grassroots?
I think it's going to be one of those, you step into the voting booth and vote your conscience type thing. I don't see any organized groups spending money for or against this. So it's sort of a very personal decision, I guess, for folks.
Wow. All right. So that's what's on your ballot. Now we've got 3 weeks from today is election day. What are the last few things that we want people to keep in mind as they start to get ready? You go first, Anna.
Yeah, people should remember that we have a lot of ways to vote in Maine. And so you can request an absentee ballot. You can do that by mail. You can request one in person at your town hall and vote it and turn it right back in person. You can mail it back in. You can drop it in a Dropbox if your town has it. You just have to get your ballot back before 8 p.m. on election day. Or you can go vote in person on election day at your polling place. And so really what matters is that you do vote, but make a plan to do it in the way that's going to be most convenient for you. And we've also just heard that, you know, the mail can be slow. Don't procrastinate. Get your ballot. If you want to vote absentee, get your ballot request in and get it turned back into your town as soon as you can. And that's the safest way to go.
Anything that you want to add to that? I guess I'm probably drifting into closing remarks here, Randy. So if you want to go ahead and make your closing remarks, go ahead.
Yeah. So maybe just a couple things. You know, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, you know, there's been a very robust and public effort to sow a lot of election disinformation and to sow mistrust in how elections are administered around the country. Within the last few weeks, I did a story about this, and I was very heartened by the fact that, you know, none of that appears to be happening in the state of Maine. The chair of the Republican Party defended Maine's system of elections, which, you know, I think a lot of folks would agree. It's basically the gold standard on how to do elections. I mean, we have paper ballots and we have voting machines that, regardless of what anyone says, they don't get connected to the internet. You know, they're not going to get hacked. Those tabulations, they take place in public, and people can go watch the whole process, casting a ballot, watching the ballots get counted. In the event that there's a recount, we have paper ballots that we actually have to transport to central location, and you can sit there and you can watch your local people count, you know, tens of thousands of ballots if you want. I feel like we just kind of had to put that out there that, you know, Maine's elections have proven to be safe and secure. And we haven't seen, you know, a lot of that erosion of public trust on a such a large scale as we have seen in some of these other swing states. And then I just think my final pitch would be, you know, just educate yourself before you go into the voting booth. And more importantly, make sure you get yourself into the voting booth. Everyone likes to say it's the most important election of your life. So let's go with that if it gets you off the couch. And the Press Herald's here as a resource for you all. Like I said, we have a landing page with all of our election coverage. We've been covering the second congressional districts very closely. And we have explainers on all these referendum questions and links and things like that. So do your part.
Wrap us up, Anna, just a few seconds more.
End us on the issue that might be on your ballot or the things on your ballot that we haven't talked about, which is the local level. And a lot of places in Maine will have local level municipal candidates or referendum questions on the ballot. And so I will plug once again, vote411.org, where we have a lot of that information listed. And your vote has this greatest impact on those local issues. Sometimes they come down to just one or two votes either way, and that can have a huge impact on the decisions that happen right where you live. So don't run out of energy by the time you get down to your municipal ballot. Use that as something to feel really good about voting on those questions.
Great show today. That's our show. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Randy Billings, political reporter for the Portland Press Herald, and Anna Keller, Executive Director for the League of Women Voters of Maine. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at weru.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in our series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next month.